Network.
On 198 Longwave and DAB Digital Radio, it's time for the Daily Service, led by Becky Harris. Here on FM, Adrian Scarborough continues reading from our new book of the week, Sapiens, A Short History of Humankind by Yuval Noah Harari. Today's instalment of this provocative account, which explores the secrets behind our success as a species, looks at science and how ignorance could hold the key to immortality.
If a peasant who lived in the year 1000 AD fell asleep and woke up 500 years later, the world would have seemed to him very familiar. Despite many changes in technology, manners and politics, the daily life of most people, the ordinary peasants, was almost exactly the same. But if a person from the year 1500 fell asleep and woke up today, he would have found himself in a world strange beyond comprehension. Is this heaven? He might well have asked himself. Or perhaps hell. Abilities which ordinary people have today, such as talking on the phone with somebody on the other side of the world, or reaching the other side of the world in 24 hours, were considered 500 years ago to be the preserves of angels and gods. How did we obtain these amazing powers? Above all, by investing resources in scientific research. Until the early modern period, humans invested very little in scientific research because they doubted their ability to obtain new medical, military and economic powers. The typical king gave money to priests, philosophers and poets in the hope that they would legitimize his rule and maintain the social order. He did not expect them to discover new medications, invent new weapons or stimulate economic growth. But over the last five centuries, humans increasingly came to believe that science can give them amazing new powers. At the basis of this ongoing process stands the greatest discovery of the modern age, a discovery that launched the scientific revolution and sustains it to this day, the discovery of ignorance. Modern humans have discovered that contrary to what all traditional cultures believed, humans do not know the answers to their most important questions. Pre-modern traditions such as Islam, Christianity and Confucianism asserted that everything that is important to know about the world was already known. They admitted only two kinds of ignorance. First, an individual might be ignorant of something important. To obtain the necessary knowledge, all he needed to do was ask somebody wiser. If a medieval peasant wanted to know how the human race originated, all he had to do was ask the local priest. Second, the entire tradition might be ignorant of unimportant things. By definition, whatever the great gods or the wise people of the past did not bother to tell us was unimportant. For example, if our medieval peasant wanted to know how spiders weave their webs, it was pointless to ask the priest because there was no answer to this question in scriptures. That did not mean, however, that Christianity was deficient. Rather, it meant that understanding how spiders weave their webs was unimportant. After all, God knew perfectly well how spiders do it. Modern-day science is a unique tradition of knowledge, inasmuch as it openly admits collective ignorance regarding the most important questions. This admission paved the way for the modern belief in our ability to acquire new powers and solve old problems. As long as people were convinced that Jesus, Muhammad, or Confucius knew everything worth knowing, and told us about it in scriptures, it followed that whatever problems they failed to solve, such as war, poverty, and disease, can never be solved in our imperfect world. We'll have to wait for the afterlife to be rid of them. But once science admitted that we still don't know some very important things about the world, it gave hope that by acquiring new knowledge, we might find a solution to war, poverty, disease, and even death. Before the late modern era, most religions took it for granted that death was our inevitable fate. Indeed, most faiths turn death into the main source of meaning in life. These creeds taught people that they must come to terms with death and pin their hopes on the afterlife rather than seek to overcome death and live forever here on earth. The best minds were busy giving meaning to death, not trying to escape it. That is the theme of the most ancient myth to come down to us, the Gilgamesh myth of ancient Mesopotamia. Its hero is the most powerful person in the world, King Gilgamesh of Uruk, who could defeat anyone in battle. One day, Gilgamesh's best friend, Enkidu, died. Gilgamesh sat by the body and observed it for many days until he saw a worm dropping out of his friend's nostril. At that moment, Gilgamesh was gripped by a terrible horror, and he resolved that he himself would never die. He would somehow find a way to defeat death. Gilgamesh then undertook a journey to the end of the universe, killing lions, battling scorpion men, and finding his way into the underworld. There, he shattered the mysterious stone things of Orshanubi, the ferryman of the River of the Dead, and found Utnapishtim, the last survivor of the primordial flood. Yet Gilgamesh failed in his quest. He returned home empty-handed, as mortal as ever, but with one new piece of wisdom. When the gods created man, Gilgamesh had learned, they set death as man's inevitable destiny, and man must learn to live with it. For men of science, death is not an inevitable destiny, but merely a technical problem. People die not because the gods decreed it, but due to various technical failures, a heart attack, cancer, an infection. And every technical problem has a technical solution. Our best minds are not wasting their time trying to give meaning to death, but are developing new medicines, revolutionary treatments and artificial organs that will lengthen our lives and might one day vanquish the Grim Reaper himself. Until recently, you would not have heard scientists or anyone else speak so bluntly. Defeat death? What nonsense! We are only trying to cure cancer, tuberculosis and Alzheimer's disease. People avoided the issue of death because the goal seemed too elusive. We're now at a point, however, where we can be frank about it. The leading project of the scientific revolution is to give humankind eternal life. How long will it take to realize King Gilgamesh's dream and overcome death? When we recall how little we knew about the human body in 1900 and how much knowledge we've gained in a single century, there is cause for optimism. Genetic engineers have recently doubled the average life expectancy of Caenorhabditis elegans worms. Could they do the same for Homo sapiens? However long it may take Project Gilgamesh to succeed, late modern ideologies such as liberalism, socialism and feminism have already taken death and the afterlife out of the equation. What exactly happens to a communist after he or she dies? What happens to a capitalist? What happens to a feminist? It is pointless to look for the answer in the writings of Marx, Milton Friedman or Simone de Beauvoir. We are living in a technical age. Many are convinced that science holds the answers to all our problems. We should just let the scientists go on with their work and they will create heaven here on earth. But science does not take place on some superior moral or spiritual plane above the rest of human activity. It, too, is shaped by economic, political, and religious interests. Science is a very expensive affair, and it has managed to achieve wonders thanks only to the willingness of governments and businesses to channel billions into research and development. Politicians and business moguls have funded science not out of pure curiosity, but because they believe it can help attain some political, economic, or ideological goal. In exchange for funding science, political and economic institutions get to influence the scientific agenda and to determine what to do with the resulting discoveries. The scientific revolution has accordingly been shaped not by science alone, but by the alliance between science and two other particularly important forces, capitalism and imperialism. Capitalism has financed science, because without science, a capitalist economy cannot function for long. Capitalism requires perpetual economic growth, which seems to fly in the face of almost everything we know about the universe. A society of wolves would be extremely foolish to believe that the supply of sheep would keep on growing indefinitely. The human economy has nevertheless managed to keep on growing throughout the modern era, thanks only to the fact that scientists come up with another discovery or gadget every few years, such as the continent of America, the internal combustion engine, or genetically engineered sheep. Imperialism, in turn, has had such close bonds with science that for most of the modern era it was impossible to separate empire builders from scientists. Both began their enterprises by admitting ignorance. "I don't know what's out there." Both then felt compelled to go out and make new discoveries, and both hoped their new knowledge would make them masters of the world. Almost every important expedition that left Europe for distant lands doubled as both military venture and scientific enterprise. In 1831, the Royal Navy sent the Beagle to map the coasts of South America, the Falkland Islands, and the Galapagos Islands. The Navy needed this knowledge in order to tighten Britain's imperial grip over the South American continent. The ship's captain decided to add a geologist to the expedition. He offered the job to a 22-year-old Cambridge graduate, Charles Darwin. And the rest is history. There is a story, or legend, that one day in 1969, as the Apollo 11 astronauts were training in a remote moon-like desert in the western United States, they came across an old Native American. The man asked them what they were doing there, and they replied that they were part of a research expedition that would shortly travel to explore the moon. When the old man heard that, he fell silent for a few moments, and then asked the astronauts if they could do him a favour. "What do you want?" they asked. "Well," said the old man, "the people of my tribe believe that holy spirits live on the moon. I was wondering if you could pass an important message to them from my people." "What's the message?" asked the astronauts. The man uttered something in his tribal language and then asked the astronauts to repeat it again and again until they had memorized it correctly. "What does it mean?" asked the astronauts. "Oh, I cannot tell you. It's a secret that only our tribe and the moon spirits are allowed to know." When they returned to their base, the astronauts searched and searched until they found someone who could speak the tribal language and asked him to translate the secret message. The translator laughed uproariously and then explained that the sentence the astronauts had memorized so carefully said, "Don't believe a single word these people are telling you. They have come to steal your lands."
Adrian Scarborough was reading Sapiens, A Short History of Humankind by Yuval Noah Harari. The book was abridged by Penny Lester and produced by Gemma Jenkins. And for more exclusive content, including an interview with the author, go to the BBC Radio 4 website. And tomorrow's episode wonders at what the future holds for the human race. Coming up after the news in Woman's Hour, Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall cooks the perfect drop scone with pumpkin seeds, and Janice Winehouse shares the challenges and heartbreak of dealing with her daughter's tragic addiction to drink and drugs as she approaches Amy's birthday this Sunday.